And welcome back to Coast, Mike Kaiser with us, The Unseen Realm. We've got much more to talk with him about, plus your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Welcome back with Michael Heiser as we continue talking about his work, The Unseen Realm. So in your opinion, Michael, the aspects of the Bible that are up for interpretation, whether it's demons, angels, Nephilim, Noah's Ark, whatever it might be, the serpent, you do believe something happened in those areas, right?
Yeah, I'm a supernaturalist. Again, I don't fall into the category that the only things that are real are the things that we can, handle with our five senses and that sort of thing. So, again, with Unseen Realm, what I'm trying to do is get people to all these topics, giants, Nephilim, Rephaim, Anakim, all those eames that you read about in the conquest narrative, and the Watchers, Satan, cosmic geography, all of this stuff. Again, I think that because I believe in a spiritual world, I think we need to treat seriously, and we're missing out on what the Bible has to say about these things when we filter it through our more recent traditions. And typically, all of our church traditions post-date the biblical period. So I just want to encourage readers, look, dump the tradition. Forget, all the things that sort of filter this to you. Go back to the primary text. Go back to the original sources itself and read that again from its own original context. And it's quite different than what you've heard before.
It's pretty different, indeed. Yeah, you're right about that. What led you in this direction? Were there things that you saw, signs that you interpreted? What got you in that direction?
Yeah, I had my sort of own epiphany when I was in graduate school at Wisconsin. I was sitting in church with a fellow member of the Hebrew department, and I can't remember what we were talking about, but I'll never forget the way the conversation ended. He had his Hebrew Bible with him, and he just flipped it open and handed it to me, and it was Psalm 82. And he said, "You need to read this." And I mean, I'm a doctoral student. I mean, I've had years of Hebrew. I've taught, on the college level. And so, what do you mean I need to read this? And so I did. And reading it in Hebrew, it literally changed my orientation, because we have Elohim Nitzav Ba'adat El. Again, Elohim, God, has taken his place in the divine council. Bekerav Elohim Yishpot, in the midst of the gods. Elohim there has to be plural because of the grammar. He held judgment. I had never seen that before. And so I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, how in the world could I have never seen this? Not only did I never see it, but I'd never even heard it. And I don't remember anything about the sermon. I don't remember anything that happened the rest of the day. That literally just was a watershed moment in my life. And it became the subject of my dissertation. That was a little over 15 years ago now. And as I was trying to unravel this, and it convinced me that, look, what you think you know, you really don't know, because you have been getting it dispensed to you from church authorities or traditions or whatnot. You need to scrap that, and you need to go back to the sources themselves. And as I started doing that, the whole thing just came alive for me. Again, all of the weird passages made sense. They connected with each other. There's a reason why, again, these strange passages are in the Bible. They're not random. They're intelligent. They're purposeful. They have a role to play in the bigger picture. And the thought hit me, I shouldn't be the only one getting the benefit out of this. And that was actually where my book, Unseen Realm, was born almost 15 years ago. I thought, I can put this stuff, all this academic stuff that I'm doing, I can make this readable and decipherable and digestible for anybody who's interested in it. It took me 15 years to do that, but that's what the book is. And again, that's why it's controversial, but I think for readers, it's why that if you read the book, you literally will never be able to read the Bible the same way again, because basically the curtain has been torn back, the cat's out of the bag, and that's what I wanted to do. I want people to experience the thrill of discovery, that I had, but it comes at a cost. You have to set your tradition aside and take an honest look at it.
Well, and there's nothing blasphemous about your interpretation at all. I don't see that.
No, I often compare it to a car ride. I mean, when I go out and speak about the book, it's always a mixed audience. Half of them know what the book is, half of them don't. And I say, look, you're going to listen to me talk about all this, again, weird stuff in the Bible, and I'm just going to tell you right now, I'm your friend. I know where you want to go, and I'm going to take you there. But it's like getting into a car with me, and I promise you I know how to get to your destination. And 5 minutes into the drive, you're looking out the window and you're thinking, I don't know. None of this looks familiar at all. Where is this crazy man taking me? What have I done? What's going to happen to me? And so I just tell him, look, you got to hang with it. I will get you to familiar territory, but the route is going to be dramatically different. So you have to just sort of stick with the ride, come along for the ride, and you'll be glad you did at the end. But it'll be uncomfortable in places for sure.
You wrote a very controversial article that got picked up by some news sites about demons. Tell me about that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. A lot of people will say that demons are fallen angels. The Bible never actually says that. Again, it's a really good example. If you actually look at, again, ancient texts between the Testaments, and some of what they say gets picked up in the New Testament, and there are threads of what they say in the Old Testament. The origin of demons actually come from, they are the disembodied spirits of dead Nephilim. All of the intertestamental traditions agree with that, and you get little snippets of it, little fragments of the idea in the Old Testament with the Rephaim. The Rephaim are the giants. And again, their disembodied spirits are in the underworld, quote unquote, Old Testament hell. And when you get to the New Testament, you have the same sort of again thinking, where demons need to be re-embodied and all that sort of stuff. So, but you never hear about the origin of demons, in sort of Bible discussion in church or again some normal kind of context. It's because the Bible, it doesn't really spell it out in one verse. You have to, again, know the context and kind of know what you're looking at. And that's why, again, it's just another reason why the content of the book is controversial. Because, what people think they know about demons, a lot of it comes from books like Paradise Lost. Like the whole idea of before creation, there was a rebellion and a third of the angels fell. Believe it or not, that is not in the Bible anywhere. The closest you get to it is Revelation chapter 12, which mentions, the dragon who is Satan, casting down a third of the stars with his tail and so on and so forth. But if you actually read Revelation 12, the context for that is explicit. It's the first coming of the Messiah. It has nothing to do with creation. But how many times have we been told this? How many times have people, come up with this idea? It is nowhere in the biblical text. But it's like this thing that, that's what the Bible says. No, it actually doesn't. So again, it's just a good illustration of what we've been told versus what's actually in this thing, and never the twain shall meet in some cases.
Let's go to the phones. You ready, Michael?
Sure.
Kevin in St. Paul, Minnesota to get things started. Hello, Kevin. Go ahead.
Yeah, hey, guys. Michael, if you're a highly intelligent Bible scholar, then I am whatever the exact opposite of that is what I am. let me throw an old question at you. In the beginning, early part of the Bible, it seems to spend an inordinate amount of time with the whole Garden of Eden thing, and then following the physical lineage of Cain, and then also following the physical lineage of Adam through Seth. And it seems to be a story of good and evil, with those two physical lineages being always at war with one another. So my question is, should we take that literally as something that physically exists in the world today, or is that just a metaphor and a fairy tale that we're supposed to learn something from?
Well, what you're really describing is sort of immediately Genesis 4. It sort of trickles into Genesis 5 because then you get the genealogies and on into Genesis 10 as well. But I mean, none of that is actually described as being an ongoing conflict. I mean, it is a conflict set in its own setting, you know, prior to the flood and then prior to Babel, that sort of thing. So it's never picked up by the New Testament, for instance. You know, conflict and evil are not described in New Testament terms broadly as going back to this particular lineage. Cain gets picked on because he was a murderer, so he'll show up a few times in the New Testament, but I would say no. It's not a paradigmatic thing for, you know, how we should sort of view the world today.
Michael, do your peers attack you much, or do they agree with you on these?
You know, it's actually been kind of surprising. The reviews of the book have been really good, especially, you know, on Amazon, but also like in journals and things like that. You know, I've benefited from that, and it's had a lot of endorsements. I mean, I have colleagues that really appreciate the content. I mean, it's not the kind of thing where, because it's such a controversial book, I'm not going to find people who would, members of the guild who would agree with everything, but people in the Old Testament field, agree with it substantially. I do have disagreements with, you know, other Old Testament scholars, and, you know, we could get together and chit chat, you know, over this or that, you know, at conferences, but by and large, it's been really wonderful, you know, to get the support, you know, from the academic community.
Barbara in Los Angeles, Wildcard Line. Good morning, Barbara. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to ask your guest. I had heard for a while that Lilith was really the first woman before Eve, and then Lilith somehow disappeared from the scene. So I'd like your comment about that, and I'll listen off the air.
Sure, Lilith.
Yeah, Lilith is an invention from rabbinic Judaism. Lilith never actually shows up in the biblical text, but she sort of became a character in the discussion of Eden because of, you know, kind of understandable questions. Well, if it's a perfect environment, how could Adam and Eve sin? You know, how could evil enter into the world? You know, how could Adam and Eve produce offspring that do bad things? And so, I mean, I hate to make it sound this way, but literally, another character was invented and inserted into the story, and that's where Lilith, you know, actually comes from. She becomes this sort of demonic figure in addition to, you know, the serpent figure, and she's just put there. I don't know how else to put it. You don't actually have it in the biblical account.
I think the Bible is an amazing book. It really is, and when you look at the stories, depending on how one interprets it, it's amazing. What are your thoughts about the Book of Revelation, Michael?
Oh boy, yeah. What a
you didn't expect that one, right?
Yeah, it's a minefield. I mean, it actually is. Let me just preface what I'll say by saying this. I think, and again, I spent a whole chapter on the book in this. I think prophecy is deliberately cryptic. In other words, that it God has intentionally made it obtuse and cryptic. And the first time around, the reason for that, I think we get the answer to that when Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 actually says that had the rulers of this world known, and that's a phrase he uses for the powers of darkness, you know, demonic powers of darkness, had they known what the result would have been, they never would have crucified Jesus, because that's the linchpin event for their own demise,
right?
And for salvation.
Good point.
And if you think about what he's saying there, he's saying it was hidden. They couldn't just like pick up an Old Testament and read it. And that's true. You don't have any of this spelled out in the Old Testament in any one place. It's splintered over dozens and dozens of places. I mean, we like to poke fun at the disciples for being kind of clueless. You know, there they are in the scene with the upper room, and the risen Christ is in front of them, and they still don't get it. You know, it actually says Jesus had to open their minds so that they would understand. And we kind of laugh at them and think, boy, what a bunch of dunderheads, you know. But the reason they didn't get it was because they weren't supposed to. And I think Revelation, prophecy the second time around, is what it is in part because it's going to work the same way. We will only be able to understand it in hindsight. It's a very difficult book. It's loaded with symbols. We tend to even the idea of reading it as a linear narrative is questionable because a lot of the content cycles back on each other, you know, 4, 5, 6 times. So does that mean it's not a linear sequence of events? Is it only 4 or 5 events that keep repeating? Like, who knows? There's no handbook to the thing. And again, all the symbols and whatnot. So I think it's that way deliberately, to be perfectly honest.
Let's go to Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia now. Hi, Michael. Good morning to you.
Hi, and thank you for having Dr. Heiser on.
Sure thing.
My question has to do with the Bible's prediction of a future paradise, and various prominent people in history and their view on how that's going to be brought about. I think of Jerry Falwell. I think of Thomas Jefferson, very, very different. And mm-hmm. I think of George Norrie, because what George has done is what nobody else in history has done. He has even eclipsed Art Bell in this regard. And that takes me back to a conversation which you had with Art Bell 15 years ago, just about this time in 2001. I called in. I was impressed with what you revealed about the nature of the plural Elohim, and I offered an analogy to explain it, which I described as being akin to Henry Ford, the Ford Motor Company, and its executives, plus his actual physical family, and how we can confuse the two, because I'm not going to try to explain it before the bottom of the hour break here, but I think you bring an awful lot to our discussion on how to prepare the world for creating a paradise through men like George Norrie, who has an open mind, who's willing to dig into these things, and if he will allow some variations in the format of the show over the future, I think we can see a dramatic change, not only in the politics and social life of America, but in the social life and politics of the whole world.
That's interesting and well said, Michael. We're going to come back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Mike Heiser with us. His work, The Unseen Realm. It's an amazing story about recovering the supernatural worldview of the Bible. Truly remarkable. Now, do you get into it all, the Antichrist, Michael, and who or what that might be?
A little bit. I'm actually working on a book now that I'll get into a little bit more of that. It's actually a book about the Book of Enoch, believe it or not. But a little bit. I think that there, I'll just put it this way. I think that there are peripheral connections between the profile of Antichrist and some of the elements of the Sons of God story, the Genesis 6 story, the Nephilim story, and that sort of thing. I don't think there's a direct line between the two things, but there are things about both of those profiles that create the possibility of some sort of relationship. But that's not actually new to me. There were early church fathers, Irenaeus is the one that comes to mind the most immediate, who entertained that possibility as well for different reasons, but you know, people can look that up in the book. So yeah, we do a little bit about that. Armageddon, there's a whole chapter in the book about Armageddon, why this is not has nothing to do with Megiddo, but it's actually a battle for Jerusalem, and Armageddon as a term does not mean Megiddo, which basically everybody says, but there's lots of reasons, again, in terms of Hebrew and the book of Revelation in Greek that suggest otherwise.
People have interpreted 1948, because that's the year Israel was reborn, basically, as the starting point for end times. Do you believe that's the case?
I don't believe that the statehood of Israel in 1948 was the specific fulfillment of any particular Old Testament prophecy. The flip side of that, though, is that I do believe that Jerusalem, as a city, does have a role to play, a very specific role, really in relationship to Armageddon itself in biblical prophecy. Just for listeners, so they kind of know what I'm talking about here. When John talks about Armageddon in the book of Revelation, he actually says that this term is from the Hebrew tongue. And what you don't get in your English translation is that the term that John writes, he's writing in Greek, is Har-Mageddon. And if you convert that back to Hebrew, Har is the word for mountain. And everyone has supposed that MGD means Megiddo. Well, there is no mountain at Megiddo. You can't have Mount Megiddo because there's no mountain there. In Hebrew, there's another letter that has the G sound. And that's actually Har Mored, which is the Mount of Assembly, the meeting place of the Divine Council, which in Old Testament theology is Jerusalem. So the fact that we have, you know, the city of Jerusalem now as part of, you know, the events, you know, of the 20th century, it's significant, but I don't think there's a direct fulfillment there of biblical prophecy on that point for that year.
Okay, let's go, Michael, to some more calls. Let's go to Gary in San Francisco, California. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Hi. Michael, I have to challenge you here, my friend.
That's all right.
Go ahead.
Okay, your entire hypothesis is based on the assumption that God said this and God wrote that. That's what you've been repeating. But I would say to you that God wrote or said none of it. These were written by men. They were borrowed legends that went way back before the time the Bible was written. And I'll also, the second part of that statement, and then I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Sure.
If God did write and say these things, why did he peg himself as a murderous, jealous, genocidal, crazy-type, maniac-type of God who killed just hundreds of thousands of people throughout his career for the most flippant and little of things? And I'll listen off the air, sir.
Good questions, Michael.
Yeah, I am so glad he asked that question. On the first part, he must have missed the discussion where I said that most of the Bible was written by men. There's very little of it that would have had to been given as revelation. That was, I guess, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So I think he probably missed that. So I'm not saying what he thought I was saying. But let's go to the whole genocide issue,
which I've always wondered about myself.
Yeah. I mean, it's cast as this sort of indiscriminate killing spree or something like this. And it's really about the conquest account in the Old Testament. The problem is that when you actually read the conquest account, there are a number of verbs that the Israelites are told to do. Only a couple of them are killing, but there's others that are not killing: drive out, expel, dispossess, whatnot, so on and so forth. So the whole thing isn't about killing. If you actually look at the verbs, and I do this in Unseen Realm, I look for the specific verbs that talk about taking of life, killing, and ask a really simple question. Where do you find them in the account? It is not a coincidence that they are found in all of the places where the Israelites spotted descendants of the Nephilim. So in other words, if you take the pronouncements to go in and kerem, devote to destruction, or some other verb of killing, if you actually note where those things occur, and they're not that frequent actually, and then you look at geographically where those places are, And then you go back and say, well, where did they see Anakim when they spied out the land? Guess what? They overlap. That's not a coincidence. What the conquest was, the killing part, I mean, and there's collateral damage because the Anakim are living among the general population. But what Joshua is told to do is to go in and eliminate specifically the giant clan, you know, vestiges, the members that are left over, you know, from antiquity. Why? Because the descendants of the Nephilim were raised up by hostile gods in the biblical story specifically to annihilate the Israelites. So you didn't have to go, you know, kill people indiscriminately, but these particular bloodlines had to be eliminated. Now, what I would like to see the caller do is I'd like to be in the caller's room when he sits down with his children, because this is the way that the God of the Bible is cast in the Old Testament. The God of the Bible says, you need to eliminate these people who want to eliminate you. It's just that simple. It's us or them. It's you or them. So when
self-defense.
I had my children, I would tell my children, look, if an intruder ever comes into the house and, you know, starts to attack us, I want you to know that Daddy will do everything in his power to save you, including killing a person. I will do that to save you. Now, I suppose that the caller with his children would say, I just want you to know that Daddy wouldn't do that to save you. Okay, I think if he says that, I think he's lying.
I don't think he would say that.
Right. I don't think he would really in reality either. But the God of Israel is cast as giving certain commands to protect the lives of his own children. That's just the way it is. This is what a father does. This is the typecasting in the Old Testament. What he tells the Israelites to do is not go kill everybody you can find. There were certain places that where God says, go into this town. And again, it just happens to be where...
Well, wasn't the flood, though? Wasn't the flood, Michael, to eradicate all that so-called evil?
Yeah, people had 120 years, again, to, you know, get on board, so to speak. Pardon the pun, pardon the metaphor there.
That's right.
They had 120 years, according to the biblical account, to take the correct side. And it's only part of the story about the human loss of life there. The other part of the story is to, again, get rid of the Nephilim. You know, all of this stuff, the conquest from start to finish, it starts in the book of Numbers under Moses and Joshua before they even get into the land. The conquest of Canaan starts and ends with the giant clans. It starts with Og of Bashan in the Transjordan, and at the end of the conquest in Joshua chapter 11, Joshua actually says, this is how he defines victory, there are no more Anakim in the land. Now, I don't think any of that is a coincidence. But we don't read the narrative with that in mind. An ancient Israelite would have picked up on this because they know the geography, they know the place names, you know, they're going to know, you know, one verb from another. We just don't read it that way. But that's what it is. The conquest is cast as Yahweh of Israel protecting his own children and saying, look, those who are bent on your destruction must be eliminated. And we would do the very same thing in our own houses. And to pretend otherwise, we're just lying. Okay? And I actually did tell that to my kids. I want you to know that I will do everything in my power to spare your life. And I would challenge you, you know, if you're a dad and you sit down with your kids and there they are at night and you tell them, well, yeah, I would do some things, but not others to protect you. Thanks a lot. Way to give them security.
I don't think most
That's
people would
ridiculous.
Say that, though. Most people would be all in.
I think they would, too. I think they would be honest at that point. But a lot of people don't want to extend the same standard to the God of Israel. And that's the way it's portrayed.
Let's go to Debbie in the Bronx. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Good to have you on.
Thank you. Awesome topic. Thank you, Dr. Iger. The gentleman who just called, whom you were speaking to, he says that God has himself portrayed as a maniac. Also, in the Bible, and back in those days, Ramses was the one who spoke a plague of death for young kids. He was considered, mm-hmm. to a point, a deity. King Herod was the one that slaughtered the babies the same time Jesus was born. He was also, to a point, considered a great deity. So it's not just God that's made to look that way. There were other major players.
You're right.
Yeah, Sarah, Mary, and Elizabeth. I have to say this, but my creator was busy because these three women gave birth to quote-unquote blessed conceptions. And there's a scripture, there's a phrase that he says, I will be back, and in 9 months, your wife will have a son. I understood that as I left my seed there, and in 9 months, part of me will come through her.
Well, let's get your take on that, Michael. Then I have a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's referring to Genesis 18. I mean, this is when Abraham entertains, you know, three quote-unquote men, you know, visitors. We find out in chapter 19 that two of them are angels that get sent to Sodom, and the third one is God himself in human form. And he announces to Abraham that, hey, you know, by this time next year, you know, by the time of this or that, again, it works out chronologically, you know, to 9 months, that Sarah, your wife, is going to have, you know, a child. And Sarah laughs, and she's not even in the scene, and you know, God hears her because he's God and says, well, you know, tell your wife not to laugh because I'm serious. The narrative never says that God did anything with Sarah, but it, of course, you know, implies that God played a role in Abraham and Sarah being able to conceive. And it's very clear that Abraham, you know, to use the biblical language, quote unquote, knew his wife. I mean, there's the sexual relationship right there. It has nothing to do with God, but there was this certain, you know, belief in certain stories. You know, Hannah is another one, you know, Mary, Sarah, you know, Elizabeth, whatnot, that God played a role in couples. And that's the key thought, couples being able to conceive. This is not God depositing, you know, a seed in any of these women. The narrative never actually says that.
Michael, what about the passage where God killed the firstborn? If you didn't put lamb's blood around your door, you know, so the angel of death would bypass you. That's kind of evil, isn't it? Killing off the firstborn of everybody? To get even?
Well, it comes from, unfortunately, you know, for Pharaoh. I mean, it was the result of, you know, Pharaoh's assault
on the Hebrews.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and so, you know, it's one of those situations again where, you know, the means that God uses to judge evil is, you know, in the end of the analysis, is up to God. I mean, could God have done something lighter? Sure. You know, God chooses not to do so. And in this case, it's something that, you know,
all these little Egyptian babies were innocent, right? They didn't do anything.
Yeah, I mean, they suffer because of the wrongdoing of their leadership. You know, and
yes.
That's just the way it works out. So sometimes God, you know, does that, allows that, again, whatever, you know, word we want to use, depending on what the context is. And he just used that to judge Pharaoh, you know, judge his own people. You know, and God, again, in the final analysis, God could use some other means, but sometimes he chooses not to. Sometimes he lets people suffer because of, you know, what they do or what somebody else does.
Let's go to Rob, first-time caller in San Diego. Rob, we'll squeeze you in real fast. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just wondering if Dr. Heiser thinks that one guardian angel can protect multiple human beings.
That's an interesting question. I think they can. Michael, what about you?
Well, I don't see why not. I mean, there are a handful of passages that talk about the idea of a guardian angels being assigned, you know, to, you know, those who believe and all that sort of stuff. And there's nothing to the contrary. In other words, there's nothing that limits that. So I think, you know, I can't give a reason why that wouldn't be the case.
Michael, let people know where they can get your book, The Unseen Realm.
Yeah, The Unseen Realm, you can get it up on Amazon. And I would encourage people to go up to Amazon and find the book. You can, of course, find the link through my website, drmsh.com, or, of course, Coast to Coast. The reviews have been great, well over 200 reviews.
Good for you.
So I invite people to, you know, read them. You'll get an idea, again, of what's in the book by reading the reviews. But the easiest place to go is for Amazon. And, of course, I'd like people to visit my website and the podcast, nakedbiblepodcast.com. We do something every week, you know, biblical stuff that you won't hear anywhere else that's unfiltered.
It's a hot topic right now. It really is. Michael, thanks for being on the show. Let's not let 15 months go by this time, all right?
Yeah, I hear you, George.
Okay, Michael Heiser. The name of the book, The Unseen Realm. Great story if you're into all kinds of things that happened many, many years ago. He's got it. Read all about it and have some fun.